Coming up on KUCB News, Unalaska schools have been in and out of home-based learning for nearly a year now, and the governor's emergency declaration expired on Sunday. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Maggie Nelson with some local news on Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. It's been nearly a year since schools were shuttered last spring in response to the arrival of the coronavirus pandemic in Alaska. And since then, in Unalaska, schools have been bouncing back and forth between three different types of learning: home-based, in-person, and a mix of the two. But that 11-month juggling act has taken its toll on teachers, parents, and students.
Sometimes those things I need to do for work make it so I don't notice the phone call when we're supposed to talk to the teacher.
That's Kate Arduzer. She's the wellness program manager for the Cowalungan Tribe of Unalaska. She's also the mother of two school-aged kids, a 5-year-old in pre-K and a second grader.
And that puts me on a cycle of like feeling like I am not maybe doing the things that I'm expecting to do well, and then I have to take a deep breath and remember to have a good attitude and to do my best and to hopefully help my children do their best, period.
Remote learning has been tough for Arduzer, as it has been for many parents who have had to take time off from their jobs, start working from home, or find other unique ways to adapt to changing circumstances during the coronavirus pandemic. Anya, Arduzer's second grader, attends class in the afternoons, Monday through Thursday, for a couple of hours through the district's hybrid learning model, where small cohorts of students attend classes 4 days a week. And her other daughter, Annika, who's in pre-K, stays home all day with Arduzer. Arduzer considers herself very lucky to be able to work from home while her kids participate in remote learning. But she says it's been challenging, emotionally, mentally, and physically.
I guess also, working at home, having that flexibility, is it manageable to do all those things?
When I have a good attitude, I guess I really believe, yes, it's all possible. And not only is it a juggle, it's a roller coaster. So that combination, like, it comes in waves all day long.
And for many families, that roller coaster recently saw a few extra corkscrews and dives. Last week, the district had made tentative plans to return to full days of in-person learning as the city shifted into the medium coronavirus risk threshold. Those plans were quickly dashed, though, when two new cases of community spread were reported and the city returned to the high-risk level. Nayeli Ramirez's son, Alexis, is in first grade. She says when she told him he might be able to go back to school full-time, he was overjoyed. Ramirez says as an only child, and with her working 12 to 14-hour days, home-based and hybrid learning has been tough on Alexis.
They give like little USB with videos from Mrs. McCallery telling them a story. He cried the first time he saw it. And I was like, why are you crying? He's like, because I love it. And I'm like, okay.
Sharon O'Malley teaches third grade at Eagles View Elementary. And right now, while some of her students have returned for afternoon in-person classes, she is one of just a few Unalaska teachers who have chosen to work from home. O'Malley says she has a great sub in her classroom that works with the kids while she Zooms in remotely. And while she prefers the hybrid model to fully home-based learning, she says her days are long and exhausting.
The kind of work that you can't just do it in one night. You can't go in and say, oh, I'm going to get everything ready for all my students tonight. It's really time-consuming.
She says the videos, along with extra instructional material for parents and personal phone calls, help provide support that she is unable to give until students and staff can return to their classrooms full-time. In the meantime, while teachers may not have much of a chance to interact face-to-face with their students, some parents, like Kate Arduzer, are working to bring aspects of the teachers themselves into their homes.
So I just pretend to be Miss Jefferson. I talk like Miss Jefferson. I'm like, Anya, what would be a strategy for that? Because quite honestly, I don't know. So I wait for Anya to tell me how to do the thing, if she's needing help, and then she does the thing. And that takes.
Arduzer and her family do a lot of performing these days. She says when she and her husband get up for yoga in the morning, they also practice fake laughing. It's a great way, Arduzer says, to trick your body into thinking that life is great. Meanwhile, many of the emergency powers the state was using to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic expired along with the governor's disaster declaration early Sunday morning. But it's not yet clear what impacts that will have on everything from vaccine distribution to curbside pickup and delivery of alcohol. Governor Mike Dunleavy and members of his administration gathered Sunday to lay out some of the changes.
You'll see that we have no mandated advisories now.
Some things, like travel testing, are clear. Alaska residents and non-residents traveling to the state are no longer required by the state to get a pre-travel COVID-19 test or to test upon arrival.
But if you wish to get on the plane at the airport without a test, you can do that.
The state advises that travelers do it, and it will still be an option to test at the airport through the end of June. But that doesn't mean that people can travel throughout the state freely without being tested. Some cities, like Juneau, are still requiring it. The administration laid out a COVID-19 transition plan, which Dunleavy characterized as moving Alaska toward normalcy. But there are a lot of other parts of the state's COVID-19 response that are going to be impacted by the lapsed disaster declaration. Some 200 regulations that had been suspended will be going back into effect. That will impact everything from curbside pickup of alcohol to telemedicine. But none of those changes actually took place Sunday. Instead, commissioners will review those policies over the next several weeks. Dunleavy says they'll advise him on what needs to stay in place and what he should allow to lapse. One other thing that isn't clear is how the state will continue allocating vaccines. Director of Public Health Heidi Hedberg said the state's disaster declaration and the plan it submitted to the federal government gave it the legal authority that it needs to distribute vaccines into communities.
And given that we feel like we will be able to continue distributing the vaccines to Alaskans at least through the month of March.
What's still unclear is how the state will legally distribute vaccines into communities after that point. Hedberg also said that the state's response to community requests may be slower. Before the November election, political groups made last-minute ad blitzes to try to tip the state house toward their agendas. But up until recently, there was no way for Alaskans to know who was paying for the attacks. Only after the election did disclosures show that at least one big Alaska corporation was involved, Anchorage telecommunications firm GCI. Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media has more on how voters were kept in the dark, but may not be next year.
If you were listening to talk radio before the November election, you might have heard this ad.
Which party controls the state house? Lance Pruitt is one of the most respected members of the legislature. Liz Snyder is supported by Ethan Berkowitz and the liberal Anchorage Assembly. She is for an income tax and government-run health care.
Snyder, a Democrat, actually refused to endorse an income tax, and she ended up just winning the race against Pruitt, the incumbent and a Republican whose supporters included, well, those behind the ad. So who is that exactly?
Message. Top contributors, Republican State Leadership Council, Families of the Last Frontier, and Bruce Campbell.
Almost all the group's money came from the Republican State Leadership Committee, a national political organization that helps get GOP legislative candidates elected. But Alaska elections law doesn't require donors like that group, the RSLC, to say where their money comes from. Which means that campaigns like Snyder's and several others targeted by the RSLC-funded attack ads last year didn't know where the money paying for them was ultimately coming from. That made it harder to respond to the ads, says Amber Lee, Snyder's campaign manager.
I mean, anytime any information you have changes to some extent what kind of research you're doing and what kind of tactics you're using.
Only after the election did the Internal Revenue Service require the RSLC to disclose its donation from GCI in a routine filing. $100,000, which is more than many legislative candidates raise over the course of their entire campaigns. That number came as a big surprise to political professionals like Lee.
Are you kidding? Wow.
Corporate executives often contribute directly to candidates, and sometimes businesses also donate to groups involved in campaigns. But a corporate donation the size of GCI's is unusual in state legislative races. The fact that few people outside the company knew about it shows just how hard it is to keep track of the money flowing into Alaska politics. Lee used to work for GCI and says she knows its leaders are politically conservative, but she also says she's perplexed about the company's involvement.
They obviously had some kind of agenda, and I don't know what that agenda would be, but, you know, there's no reason that a group like GCI would put money into something unless it benefited their business model.
GCI declined to make anyone available for an interview, but a spokeswoman says the company donates to the RSLC because of their advocacy for candidates who support strong economic policy and businesses like GCI. The RSLC wasn't the only big outside funder of efforts to influence Alaska's legislative campaigns last year. On the Democratic side, progressive groups that don't reveal their donors also made 5- and 6-figure contributions. And because those groups are organized differently, the public still doesn't know who their donors are and whether any are based inside the state. That will change starting this year, though. A citizens' initiative that passed in November will force groups to disclose what the initiative calls the true source of their financial contributions, which Shea Siegert, the initiative's campaign manager, says will provide more accountability for donors like GCI.
Getting this information from various IRS tax documents in February for money that was spent to influence Alaskan voters in a November of last year election does nothing for the voters. And so that is the problem that ballot measure 2 aimed to fix.
The initiative's rules requiring greater disclosure will take effect in time for this spring's Anchorage mayoral election, Siegert says. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
And the Board of Education for the Unalaska City School District meets tonight via teleconference and Zoom. At their regular session, members will be discussing the budget for the upcoming fiscal year, and will also be addressing the district's academic performance. The school board meets tonight at 7 o'clock. You can find the access number on the school district's website at ucsd.net, or listen live here on 89.7 FM. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Maggie Nelson, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. And please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts.